Hey, Mike, can you get that door back there? Thanks, Anna. So today we have three bills. I don't know if they're labeled the biofuel package, but they've obtained that vernacular. And so what we'll do is we're just going to have public hearings today, and we'll open all three bills. And Chris, maybe if you could just give a brief introduction, and I think Mike Graney's going to give us a 5 or 10 minute walkthrough. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 2210. Open a public hearing on actually, that was House Bill 2210. I think this is our first House bill we've done. House Bill 2211, and open a public hearing on House Bill 2212. Chris.
Mr. Chair, just very briefly then, House Bill 2212 makes certain modifications to the Residential Energy Tax Credit Program. And I guess Energy is going to walk through the details of that. House Bill 2211 makes various changes to the Business Energy Tax Credit, so those are the RETC and BETC programs. And then House Bill 2210 is much more detailed and does makes a lot of changes and creates a couple of credits with respect to biofuels. So those are kind of the topic sentences for those three bills, if you will.
I will. Great. Mr. Graney. And someone else.
Morning, Mr. Chairman.
Good morning.
Members of the committee. Mike Graney, Director of the Department of Energy, and with me is Bill Nesmith, who's Assistant Director, and he runs our tax credit programs. Let me give a brief summary of each bill. The three bills are part of the governor's energy package, they are part of a package to encourage greater use of renewable energy in fuels through the biofuels and through electricity and in direct use in homes and businesses. Mentioned just generally that all three bills had an extensive review in the House committee. There's four tax credits in the three bills, and it's the revenue and the tax credits provisions I'll particularly focus on in the biofuels bill. They all have sunset dates now in the tax credits. Not all of them did initially as they were introduced. They also have benchmarks for evaluating the effectiveness of the programs, and there's a separate benchmark for each tax credit that is one of the handouts that's being given out there that we worked through with the House committee, and there's a memo to Chairman Barnhart about the benchmarks there.
So Mike, can we start with 2210, and
yes.
We'll start with that one and just work through where is the sunset, what are the benchmarks, the revenue impact. We can work with Chris. So we're adding up our total in terms of revenue impact.
Correct. Yes, Mr. Chairman, and I should mention that these bills were in the governor's recommended budget. House Bill 2210 has two tax credits, a producer tax credit for the production of the feedstock and for going into biofuel. This is intended to provide encouragement for in-state production starting from literally from the start of the creation of the material itself through the processing facilities. Other provisions in both 2210 and in 2211 will help the capital costs of the production facilities and for infrastructure for distribution facilities and for example, fueling pumps, that type of thing at gas stations to handle biofuels. But the producer tax credit, and there's a consumer tax credit in 2210 as well. The producer tax credit initially in the House as initially drafted would have been about $5 million a year. It was changed substantially in the dollar amount and in the amount of the incentives so that And Chris, correct me if I'm wrong, it's in the neighborhood now about $5 million to biennium.
4.4.
And the consumer credit is about another $1 million of biennium. That's also in 2210. 2210 also has a number of provisions that do not have revenue impacts on the state. For example, there's a property tax exemption for production facilities. There's a renewable fuel standard for requiring a certain percentage of biodiesel and ethanol be sold in fuel in the state based on in-state production levels. There's also a prohibition on the use of MTBE as an oxidant, as well as other additives. There's direction for greater use by state agencies of biodiesel for backup electric generation. There's also a modification of an exemption that was passed last session on site certificates for large production facilities to preclude the use of coal burning to power these production facilities. That was an unintended oversight that we've started to see in the Midwest occur since passage of the bill last session. Finally, the bill includes provisions to allow use of biofuel production facilities on farmland that's zoned for exclusive farm use, provided it meets certain conditions regarding the size of the facility and the source of the feedstock that's consistent with other incidental uses as part of the agricultural industry for production and distribution of crops and crop products. That's basically the 2210 in a nutshell, and I can go into more details or
so. I'm going to violate what I told you at the start and ask you a bunch of questions about the producer and the consumer tax credit.
Okay, so if we could start with the producer tax credit, the rationale for it, and as we go through the mechanics of it, and why we selected certain items or crops, and
right.
Why we didn't select others.
Mr. Chairman, in general, this all three of these bills, and this bill in particular, we spent about a year working through a group we called the Renewable Energy Working Group. That was a broad-based group. We had utilities, we had renewable energy industry members, we had the Farm Bureau, we had forest products industry business groups, and we had a subcommittee specifically on biomass going through these different sections of the bill, starting with the bill from last session and making very significant changes. And this producer credit in particular was viewed as being important to be able to have an impact to provide in-state production and growth by our farmers and by our forest products people to be able to use to contribute to biofuels. Each of those incentive levels was carefully reviewed and gone over by this working group, and then when we got into the House committee, changes were made to reduce the revenue impact overall because of the size of the revenue impact.
So
we can walk through the individual ones if you'd like.
Well, let's. I think we should to get a good understanding of the producer and then the consumer. And
okay, I'm going to
think the natural first question, Mike, on all of these would be, why does the state need to provide that incentive? We've got a renewable fuel standard in here, creating a market or helping create a market. Why wouldn't a market just adapt? That would be a huge
right.
step to just say here it is. And why would the state need to put any other incentives on the producer side?
Right. And I've asked Justin Kluwer, who works for our agency, and he staffed that committee to join us as well. But in general, the reason for that incentive is while we want to increase the availability and use of biofuels in the state, we don't want it just to be coming from out of state. So, and initially, certainly, most of the feedstock for the ethanol will likely come out of state from the Midwest. We don't have that much material that can be, at least initially, readily converted to ethanol. Most of our material would be require cellulosic conversion, and that technology is coming, but it's not yet cost-effective. It's about twice as much cost as Midwest corn at this point. These incentives are intended to try to help Oregon feedstocks develop, so that we'd have local benefits throughout the entire chain, from growth of the feedstock to production facilities in-state, using, to the extent possible, local feedstock, although they're not required to use local feedstock, and then local retail sales that will benefit the community as well, and then use in terms of cleaner air and reduced consumption of petroleum products. That's the general reason for all of those incentives in that section.
So if I'm a producer and I have a market that's been basically insured to me, why would I need help or an incentive from the state? Why wouldn't I see the market? I know it's there. It's in-state law. And just start pricing my product at a level that allows me to make a return on that market.
Mr. Chairman, for the production facility that actually makes the fuel, that's correct. This goes a step back to the input into that facility so that we can get some of the local input as well, so it's not just all out-of-state and out-of-region input. That's the purpose for that incentive. And this credit is new, is different from last session's bill. This was as the working group worked through this, the bill from last session, there were other tax credits in that bill, but they said that those weren't needed. What was needed was something to deal with generating local feedstock up front. So that's the reason in general. And the different levels we went back and forth on, but those were generally the levels that were recommended for each of those specific products and areas to make a difference, to provide adequate incentive for people to be able to produce those feedstocks and materials.
Other questions on the producer tax credit? And just briefly, just on the mechanics of it, how I would, and I know Department of Revenue is here, way in the back corner, good place. if just the mechanics of how it would, how I would apply, receive the tax credit.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, that is a tax credit that would be essentially self-operating by. It'd be an additional line on the various tax forms. It doesn't require review of particular projects like business energy tax credit does by our department, so it doesn't have a fiscal impact in terms of agency operations or anything like that. It's designed to be a straightforward, you get the tax credit based on the amount of expenses you incurred related to this or production of the output for each of these different components.
So, and department, and we can do this offline, if you could just let me know how we use that expensing, and maybe the other members of the committee, just how we would verify. I planted these crops, they went in, this is how I received, how we would verify the expensing.
Yes, there'd be the usual verification requirements, and you'd be subject to, the record keeping and auditing requirements, as you would for any tax credit or deduction claim.
Okay. Other questions on the producer?
Okay. The other credit in 2210 is a consumer credit, a user credit, and it's intended for purchasers of E85% ethanol, B99 biodiesel for their cars. It's also the changes that the House made was to make it available for home heating as well, for B20 biodiesel that can be used in its replacement for heating oil, and also for high-efficiency wood stoves, for wood pellets and other very high-efficiency wood stoves. And these are stoves that would be certified and approved by the Department of Environmental Quality. It would be a substantial improvement over older wood-burning stoves and fireplaces. And that credit, as a maximum amount per household, and it varies whether it's for fuel or for vehicles or for home heating. That credit, we estimate, is about $1 million for next biennium.
Scott, again, just the rationale for, I mean, I would have the same nature of question of, you know, what's going on in the petroleum market, the rationale for the state involving itself on the incentive side.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Mechanics and
again, this bill is intended, in conjunction with 2211 and to a certain extent 2212, to cover the entire range of the biofuel production and use, to try to provide incentives where there are needs throughout this chain, so that there's incentives for, on the one hand, feedstock that we discussed previously. In 2210, there's also incentives for the production facilities, the property tax exemption, and then 2211 has incentives for the capital costs of the production facilities. What the consumer credit provides is an incentive for use of the product, because it will have a higher cost. E85 and B99 do have a higher cost. High efficiency wood stoves and the wood pellets and wood fuel to run them have a higher cost. That's why there's the tax credit, to try to overcome that cost or partially overcome that.
And before we get into just the mechanics of it, how could $1 million, if, you know, given the higher cost, $1 million in a medium-sized state like Oregon doesn't do very much at all to ameliorate if there is a cost differential? I mean, people make decisions because they want to be more environmentally friendly. They want to buy different fuels. How would that $1 million actually do any good to help a consumer?
Mr. Chairman, we base that based on the assumption of the, you know, amount of homes and families that would take advantage of it. I think potentially that credit could increase in time in terms of the number of people using it. There is a limit, a top per customer, so that would hopefully keep the revenue impact from making a major dent. There is also a sunset, I think 2012, I believe, for both the tax credits and the biofuel bill, and that would give us an opportunity to look at whether those two credits should be continued in their current form at that point with that sunset. I think that would give us enough time to evaluate the effectiveness of both the front end of the market and the back end that we're trying to help incent with these bills.
So we'll just keep it to the mechanics of, and we'll rely on the department for some of this, but anything you could help us with?
For this credit, we would set the criteria, define what qualifies, and we would work with Department of Revenue on that. And then in turn, there's not a pre-approval process like there is for the residential and business energy tax credits, but people would have to have the documentation that they're both in terms of the dollar amount, what they've spent, and verify that what they've spent, you know, qualifies for the incentive, that they're buying B99 or E85, and that they're buying fuel for DEQ-certified stoves, the high-efficiency stoves, not just a load of firewood. You know, so there is the verification that would be required, and that you'd be subject to, you know, if you're subject to an audit or request for those documentation, you have to provide that.
Still not clear on how $1 million, given the scope of this issue, is actually going to, in the form of a tax credit that sunsets in 5 years, but how that would make that much of a difference in consumer decision-making.
Well, and Mr. Chairman, for each individual consumer, it's a couple hundred dollars. It's capped at $200, I believe, per household. So it's not a huge incentive. I mean, by comparison, you know, for our residential tax credit, the tax credits range from anywhere from for renewable energy from $1,500 to higher for the investments, up to $6,000. Again, this is for the cost of fuel. So a couple hundred dollars a year on the cost of fuel could make a difference. We see for our energy efficient appliances that are covered by 2212, and some of those the credit is only a couple hundred dollars for things like dishwashers and clothes washers versus it's much higher for refrigerators and freezers. But we see a lot of the more efficient models because of just that $200 or $300 credit. So it can make a difference to people. And, you know, if it's sometimes it's an incentive that encourages people to do things they might want to do anyway, but they're willing then to make that investment because they want a cleaner environment. They want to be more efficient in their energy use. So I think it could have some impacts, some beneficial impacts. At the same time, we were sensitive to the revenue constraints and not trying to make this credit open-ended either in terms of dollar amount or length of duration.
Questions on the producer or the consumer? Next credit.
Sure.
Senator Monroe.
85% ethanol is sold at a station near my house. It's cheaper than gas.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Monroe, gas price has been going right now. It's probably true. And this could be that this credit proves unnecessary the next few years. I don't know if gas prices will continue to stay this high. Certainly, the pressures on gas prices are going to continue to be high in the foreseeable future. But we have seen fluctuations. Traditionally, E85 and B99 have cost more than gasoline and normal diesel. But currently, right now, we do have a lot of price variation with the high price that gasoline currently is.
But E85, you have to have your car set up for it.
Yes.
You can't burn it in a regular car. I mean,
no, Mr. Chairman, Senator Monroe, you have to have a car that's a flexible fuel E85 car.
And how much would it cost to convert over to that?
Well, most of the cars that run on E85 are new cars. And that incremental cost, I think, is about $1,500 or so. It's only a couple hundred now. But for a conversion of an existing car, that would be about $1,500.
Oh, okay.
So that would be, that's
the
more expensive process.
The credit would help, Mr. Chair, the credit would help offset the additional cost of buying a vehicle that's set up for E85.
It would, as well as the residential tax credit would as well.
Okay. And Mr. Chair, it's also my understanding, in fact, I think it's pretty well known that you don't get as good a fuel economy with E85. It doesn't have as much energy in it as regular standard gasoline.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Monroe, that's correct. In general, there's less BTU in alcohol fuel than there is in gasoline, just per gallon or per liter, however you would measure it. It's about two-thirds, I think, isn't it?
Mr. Chair, on the clean diesel, is it comparable to standard number two diesel in terms of its BTU content and the fuel efficiency?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Monroe, that's correct. For biodiesel, it is comparable. And it, say again.
You got to do that. I'm Justin Kler.
I'm sorry. With the Department of Energy. So yes, it is. It is the equivalent as far as energy content from number two diesel to a biodiesel blend.
Okay. Thank you.
Just a second. before we, on Section 5, who were the skeptics in the room as you're going through finding the feedstocks and negotiating what's in and what's out? And it's always a good discussion when there's a tax credit involved because let's get us all in. Who were the skeptics in the room that said, I don't know about that one, or let's take this one off the list?
Mr. Chairman, in general, there was, as the bill was being developed over the last year, and as it was heard in the House, there really weren't skeptics. I would say there was broad support for the incentives. Recently, there's been some concern, and we'll hear more of it today, that there could be an imbalance, an unintended effect on some of the agricultural community and the need for competing feedstock for competing uses, such as for dairy feed for cattle. The intent is not to disadvantage any segment of the Oregon agricultural industry. I think we'll need to carefully evaluate this, and it could be that the credit does need modifying for some of these one or more components that's listed. But in general, I think as the bill was being developed in your working group, were there any really strong objections to any particular measures?
No. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there wasn't any strong objections. What was determined as far as the list of feedstock or what feedstocks can be grown here in the state? And so that's kind of how that list was determined. And then making the dollar amount was based on what that incremental difference may be as compared to importing those feedstocks from out of the state or the incentive level that's needed for a farmer to make the transition from growing a conventional crop to a biofuel crop.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I'm going to look to Senator George on some of these questions just on the Section 5 of the bill. He knows so much more about feedstocks and agricultural products that would be helpful. And I'll ask Senator George to look into that. It's always healthy when my experience on tax incentives is as long as you've got everyone in a room and you're developing a tax incentive, the more the merrier. And so it would just, to me, be helpful to have some eyes just on the particular feedstocks and so that skeptic somehow is, and I'm sure it happened in the work group, I'm sure there was robust discussion around that.
Never heard of it.
There was indeed, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, as far as the vetting of the type of feedstock that the state has a competitive advantage over, as well as that dollar amount that's required to make the push to grow that feedstock and then convert it to a biofuel.
Senator George.
Thanks. A couple of questions. One of the things that I've noticed in California is that many of those biomass generators, you know, mainly they were burning it, converting to steam and producing electricity that way, they're shut down now. And there was quite an operation. They were sited, of course, in rural areas so they could be near agriculture, which I don't know if with our land use laws we're going to be able to quite do that. But have you guys tracked California as to what has happened to those? I still see them sitting idle. And these were massive investments, and that's why I'm concerned 5 years down the road, incentives come off and the plant's shut down. And because what I've been told is we're going to be subsidizing this forever, that it's going to require a subsidy in order to make it work, even for biodiesel and for alcohol particularly. Any comment about that? Do you guys know anything about the closure of many of those operations in California?
Mr. Chair, Senator George, I haven't tracked specifically what's going on in California as far as those closures. I do know for a biomass facility, access to feedstock from a geographical location is absolutely critical.
Sure.
So as far as transportation from the feedstock to the plant, if that distance grows, you know, beyond a certain radius, then it's uneconomical to bring that feedstock. And I think that's one thing that Oregon has, and as a developer would definitely be looking at where that access to feedstock and locating those facilities to where they can attract a 10-year supply per se of that feedstock. So if anything, I think Oregon has an advantage to take some of those lessons learned from California, and as facilities are being sited, understand the limitations to that feedstock from a geographic perspective, and ensure that that plant has an adequate supply over the long term for that feedstock source.
Could your department do a little research for us on what happened down there? Because I know of three of them, major facilities that are still sitting idle, tumbleweeds blowing across the lot. Very, very expensive facilities. My next question is that I was watching a British Petroleum ad last night, and the guy's holding a sugar beet. Well, I used to raise those things, so I understand a sugar beet. And but what I've been told is that very similar to producing sugar from sugar beets today, you can't compete with corn, you can't compete with foreign sugar growers, you know, with cane and other beet growers in other locations. So have you guys had anyone come to you suggesting that we go back to producing sugar beets? Because we have not only in the valley been a grower of sugar beet seed, but the state has been a pretty major producer in the past, particularly on the east side. The potential for yield is very, very great, and the byproduct should be good cattle feed. Have you guys heard anything about that issue?
Mr. Chair, Senator George, I've had conversations over the last year or two with potential sugar beet, producers, and I think from a technical perspective, it's relatively simple to distill down the sugar into an alcohol fuel. So I think it's certainly advantageous for us to revisit that. And looking at the bill as proposed, you're creating a marketplace, and you're bringing in some of that incentive for folks to look at other feedstocks. And sugar beet, I think, is one candidate, as well as this cellulosic ethanol conversion. If folks understand a market and there's an incentive to come into the marketplace, I think Oregon has that opportunity to expand on those feedstocks and that alcohol production.
Thank you.
That's for our 5 minutes, Mike.
Should I move on to 2211 then?
I think we did the producer, we did the consumer in 2210.
And there are no other tax credits in 2210.
Yeah, I think we should go on to the next bill. So Representative Dean Felder, we have a lot of questions for this panel. Do you want to testify or do you want to wait? And
I would just like to say a few words because we're on the floor and I've been excused, and so I do need to get back.
Okay, so why don't we have two stay and one?
I'm not going to be very long.
And Mike Green's happy to leave and not come back, probably. Two of you can stay. This is a study in human nature. Every time I say two can stay, they all leave.
I hope it's not me, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm State Representative Jackie Dingfelder, House District 45. And I, first of all, want to thank the chair and for the members for hearing these bills. As you probably know, I've worked for now, this is the second session on this particular idea, the biofuels bills, and have been working on this with the Department of Energy and many of the people sitting behind me in multiple meetings over the past, 3 years. We've been working on many of these issues. I will say that, first of all, I want to thank the Department of Energy for their hard work, and I have to say that Mr. Greeny is always there whenever I call him, noon, night, morning, and to answer questions and to assist, and I've been very appreciative of the work the department has done, along with many of the people who served on the work groups. What you see in front of you is the culmination of many, many, many hours of meetings, of input, of hearings. We had over 2 weeks of hearings in my substantive committee before it went on to the revenue committee, and I think what you see in front of you is a very well-vetted bill. We had lots of discussions about many of the issues that you've been talking about this morning, and I just want to emphasize a couple of things. First of all, the intent of these the three pieces of legislation in front of you, but particularly 2210, is really the intent is to jumpstart the industry and not to be a long-term continual source of funding, just to address Senator George's question or comments there. As a matter of fact, we put on a sunset in the House Revenue Committee for that reason. And I think, if anything, what we're going to see is a continual increase in traditional gas prices. I'm not really optimistic that we're going to actually see a decrease, although I certainly hope that we would. But I think, if anything, we're going to see biofuels be more cost competitive. What we're doing here is helping jumpstart the industry, help make sure that this is a viable what I want to say, viable in-state operations, because instead of sending money, as you know, out of state or overseas, we can actually invest here in Oregon, create jobs, and help farmers in the rural communities at the same time. That's one of the things I think is really beautiful about this bill. It's a real win-win for Oregon, bridging the urban-rural gap. There's many issues we're working on this session. Renewable energy is another one. So I have been very impressed with the folks who have spent a lot of time and effort and been very thoughtful on this bill. The farming community, the petroleum industry has really come to the table and worked with us on a lot of these issues. We've had the environmental and consumer groups, and really across the board. I've heard, I think, this session more from folks in Eastern Oregon on many of these issues than I've ever before, and they're really supportive. We've had lots and lots of testimony in my committee. So I would urge you to move these bills forward. I think we only had four no votes, if I'm correct, over in the House floor, so overwhelming bipartisan support. And I think the bill that you have in front of you has had a lot of thought put into, especially the tax incentive piece, because we needed to reach a fine balance where we're giving enough of an incentive to jumpstart the industry, however, being very aware about the impacts on the general fund and certainly the trade-offs that we have in those decisions. So I think we found a good balance in this bill. Also, 2211 and 2212 do more probably for promoting renewable energy and energy efficiency, I think, than almost any other program we have in the state, and also for reducing greenhouse emissions. So I really thank, again, the committee for your hard work and would urge support. And I'd be happy to answer any questions. I know you have the experts here, and you'll continue to grill them after I leave. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Dingfelder. And you have been at this for, three or four years. And you're also correct that Mike Rainey is a... Behind so many good decisions stands Mike Greene that this body's made and the state's made. So I appreciate you noting that. Questions, yes, Senator Torch.
Representative, I mentioned the land use issue. And of course, we're going to cite these things. You don't want them in town. You want them out in the rural areas, as Mike talked about. What's your opinion as to where we are relative to being able to cite these things appropriately to the location where the product is going to be produced?
That's an excellent question, Mr. Chair and Senator George. And as a matter of fact, if you look on page 15 of the bill in section 34, this is the exclusive farm use for on-farm biofuel production. And we work closely with the agricultural community and the Department of Land Conservation Development. This was consensus language that was developed, sitting down with all those parties to make sure that we wouldn't, I mean, one of the things we don't want to create is a situation, first of all, for folks who want to create produce biofuels on farm, that they're able to do that and not they're not going to have problems siting a facility. The other thing, too, is we don't want to create even more inefficient use of gas by, you know, having people to drive really far for these facilities. So that was, I think we had a lot of thought put into that. I don't think we're going to have a lot of problems in my discussions with DLCD. That really did not come up as an issue during any of our testimony. And if anything, I think that counties would be really supportive because it's going to be income coming into their local districts. I don't know if you have any other comments on that.
Was there much discussion around, I mean, one of the ways to get at Senator George's issue of continually subsidizing, we go through this on, do you do the incentive side or do you just allocate and use that to fuel, or there's so many analogies here, I'll try to avoid them, to just allocate $5 million, help jumpstart that industry, but then it's more in the nature of a one-time or a couple-time, and it's certainly, I think you could argue, a good decision for the state to put some of its general fund dollars out on the street. To how do you feel, or what was the discussion around that approach of let's just allocate some general fund dollars out there for two or three years, make the commitment for a while that we will actually match people in terms of production for a while just to provide that that jump start?
Well, I think that, I mean, that really is the intent of the legislation. As I said, it's not to for the state to get in the business of, you know, continually funding biofuels. I really believe that the industry is and will be competitive, especially with the increase in fuel prices. And I think that more and more people, I mean, I hear not just people in my district, but all over the state that are really supportive of this for a number of reasons. One, they would like to use and see B99 and E85 be used, I guess, you know, more frequently. And right now there's just not a lot of incentive. And we have a couple of things in the bill, you know, the consumer credit that you were talking about. It sounds small, but it's amazing how many people I've had that say, yeah, I would do that, because it just is that extra little bump that they need in order to purchase that product. It also provides an incentive for the fueling stations to actually provide that, which part of the challenge now is that there isn't widespread availability of biofuels or ethanol E85. Certainly the city of Portland, because they have adopted a higher standard than we have, I think will help in the Portland metropolitan area, but I'd like to see this policy statewide and give people throughout the entire state of Oregon the opportunity to purchase these fuels. I do believe that it is the intent, once again, to jumpstart the industry and provide sort of the initial investment, investing here in Oregon, investing in Oregon jobs and Oregon's economy, and helping grow both the biofuels, the ethanol, and biodiesel industries.
So did y'all talk about, I mean, you'd house it in the Department of Agriculture, you'd make it some sort of a grant program. I'm sure there's some match.
That did not come up as a discussion.
And you'd put $4.5 or $5.5 million, and that in some ways ensures you really are doing that jump start and not creating a new incentive that tend to be hard to, once you've got folks utilizing them, tend to be hard to wean.
Mr. Chair and Senator and committee members, and then I'll ask Mike Graney to respond. I guess the way I see it is this really is trying to make the market work better, and having as little state involvement as far as administration. I mean, the thing about a grant program, and we have lots of grant programs and supportive and worked, for instance, with our many of our agencies who have grant programs, it is another layer of bureaucracy that you'd be dealing with. I mean, you'd have to set up a whole system of grant criteria and grant evaluation, and then, you know, it takes that much more time to get things on the ground. We're here, we're saying, hey, you know, the market's starting, let's help it work a little bit better. We all know that there's lots of subsidies out there at the federal level for the traditional petroleum industry, and we're saying let's give the renewable fuel industry a little help here in starting up. But the market is there. We're helping boost that market. And so I guess the way I see it is this is a more efficient way to get the dollars on the ground.
I agree with that, Mr. Chair. With the grant, you have winners and losers. With the tax credit, everybody who's able to participate has the availability of the incentive, and we see a lot of advantages to that.
Good point. Thank you, Representative Dingfelder. Sorry to keep you from the floor, and appreciate it's been a long struggle or journey, so appreciate all the time you've put into it.
Well, I thank you, and if you have any specific questions that you need me for, I will be happy to come back or talk to individuals. I, again, want to say that there's people in this room who have worked on this for many years and have excellent levels of expertise that hopefully will be able to answer the questions. But I hope that you will seriously consider moving this forward, and I know that there's a lot of support and would be right there. Like I said, the House sent this over overwhelmingly, and especially I was really pleased to see, considering this became somewhat of a contentious issue last session, that there was so much bipartisan support this session, and so I urge your support.
Great.
Thank you.
So we made it 20 minutes without a call of the House, so that's a good accomplishment. Okay, so Mike, how about we do this? Can we just stay on 2210 for now?
Sure.
Since that seems to be, like you said, where folks are, and we're just doing public hearings today.
Sure.
So we'll go through our list on 2210, and then we can talk more about 11 and 12.
That'd be fine, Mr. Chairman.
That works. So maybe we'll organize it this. Why don't we do the producer tax credit first? So let's hear from Katie Fast, Jim Cron, Dave Nelson, who I'm assuming were part of the group and would be advocates for the producer tax credit.
Sure. kick it off. For the record, Katie Fass with Oregon Farm Bureau. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of 2210. I served on the Renewable Energy Working Group and the Biofuel Subcommittee and was involved in the drafting of this legislation. And Farm Bureau is supportive of the package. However, we do have concerns that have been raised through the livestock industry regarding the 90-cent tax credit that is in the producer tax credit section and section 5 that you've been focusing on. There is concerns that this tax credit for grain producers will be a surcharge and an additional increase on livestock feed through competition. And we are bringing forward a request to modify that tax credit in a way that makes the livestock industry comfortable. That could be removing corn from the definition of a grain crop or reducing the subsidy level to a lower point than 90 cents or both. But we're happy to work with the committee and the livestock industry, but we are requesting that amendment to the bill. In addition, I'd like to also talk about the land use section as well. Farm Bureau was involved and brought the amendments forward on the House side to amend for the tax credit or for the property section. So it'll allow farmers who are growing crops themselves and producing those into biofuels on site or are purchasing crops from local farmers to produce fuel for their own farm use. It'll allow that to be a permitted outright use. And then for those farmers who are using a percentage of crops that they grow and then allowing other farmers to bring in for sale, that'll be a permitted use. And then for larger facilities that'll be servicing the agricultural area, that would be a conditional land use. So it would go through the county review and permitting process. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any additional questions.
Katie. Questions for Katie. Senator George.
Katie, what I'm looking here on page 17, it says the landowner is custom processing crop into biofuel from other landowners in the area for their use or sale. It seems to tie it back to kind of an ag-only type operation rather than a person who would be sending it to the BP station to be sold to anyone.
And that was the intent of those sections where it's either an outright use or a permitted use, that is more of servicing the ag community in the area and not for the larger facilities that might have a disconnect with the agricultural infrastructure.
Follow-up questions? We know that these things don't belong near a city. You don't want a refinery near a city. You don't want anything that's highly flammable. It could be explosive. You don't want anything near a city. The best location, since it's going to occupy a certain footprint, let's say it occupies 30 acres. It's either 30 acres in an industrial zone, which was taken from agriculture to produce it in the valley, or it's going to be 30 acres in an agriculture area in which the farmers will be using it. So that's a question, and I guess I'm going to cheat a little bit and actually tag another question on there. And we're having a little problem with the guys that are moving the grass seed straw and being able to use their farm plates. Do we have any provision here to make sure that the person that is moving products to these things will be able to utilize their farm plates?
No, there's not that clarification in the legislation. But, part of the discussion that we had is for the facilities that Oregon Agriculture is going to be delivering to, it is important that they're kind of located in farm areas so that we do reduce on transportation costs for the farmer and they're able to economically deliver crops to the facilities. But no guarantees on what type of plates they'll be driving with.
Any thoughts on the discussion around the Section 5, just what products got included and what products were not included? And
well, Senator Deckard, I think looking at the section was put together, looking at what can Oregon grow and what's the interest on facilities moving in. And for your questions and concerns regarding, why are we asking for this 5-year tax credit? And from a livestock and perspective, you know, there are concerns for that grain producer, but for like the biodiesel side of things, producers growing the oilseed crops, they're going to be growing crops that are in many times new to the area. So they're taking some risk on how are these crops going to perform in Klamath Falls, where we've never grown canola, or how are we going to try chamomilla or some of the alternative crops to canola in the Willamette Valley. And that's why these tax credits were brought forward. Additionally, you know, farmers are going to be putting out some outright expense as well, where 2011, that legislation is going to help on purchasing either new equipment, land bases, or storage facilities for seed, because we're in a situation where we're going to have to store the crops up for delivery, you know, throughout the year. You know, a lot of these facilities may not be able to deliver at the time of harvest. So storage, on-farm storage is going to be important. Additionally, you know, we have a great deal of opportunity in the state for cellulosic ethanol, which is a new technology. And part of the concern with cellulosic ethanol is not the product that you're going to get, but the cost of delivery when you're looking at taking biomass timber fillings off the federal forest. Additionally, when you're looking at, you know, hauling grass straw, which except for recently hasn't had much value to it, but it has a high transportation cost to get it to the facility. So that's why we're seeing those tax credits. They do have a sunset in the provision for them, so it gives an opportunity for the legislature to look at them and see, you know, if they're needed any longer, if they should be tweaked, or if they should go away.
Thank you. Dave, you look like you're ready.
For a question for Katie. The amendment you suggested, deleting corn or something similar, did you present that on the House side?
Senator Deckard and Senator Munro, no, we did not. I will say Farm Bureau did feel when the House, when the bill was in the House Revenue Committee, you know, in discussions in the hallway, we were more at the 25-cent level for that grain producer crop. There were discussions and a request by some of the facilities interested in utilizing wheat for a higher level of a tax credit. So we agreed with that and moved it forward. As the bill progressed over the Senate, then the additional concerns from the livestock industry came forward, and that's why I think you're going to hear quite a few comments from several folks on that particular tax credit.
So they think paying a tax credit for somebody to grow corn to convert to ethanol is going to increase the cost of corn for livestock feed?
Yes. We must feed corn as part of the ration for the dairy industry and the beef industry. And already Oregon is a feed short state where we import feed for our livestock rations already. So we're looking at direct competition with the ethanol facilities. Market-based, you know, competition's fine, and we're supportive of that competition, and seeing a high price in corn is benefiting other segments of agriculture. However, when we're looking at a situation where government's going to come in and subsidize one segment of the market, we're going to see a direct competition with livestock feed and acres potentially converted to service the ethanol facilities that had been previously producing cattle feed. So that's where the concern comes from, the 90 cents.
I think Bergstein's, I don't see him, but he's got a panel.
How much feed corn do we produce in Oregon?
You know, I don't have that number on the top of my head, but I think you might hear that from one of the previous panels. And there's also concerns about, you know, alfalfa fields and other feedstocks being converted over to service the ethanol with corn.
I know we produce a lot of alfalfa. I know we produce some sweet corn, but I thought feed corn was primarily from the Midwest.
I think you'll hear that we produce more feed corn, actually, than we produce sweet corn in terms of silage for the dairy industry.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Dave Nelson today representing the Oregon Dairy Farmers Association. And basically, our concern is, and we weren't at the discussion of the 90-cent per bushel subsidy for wheat or for corn and feed grains and other products like that. Basically, our concern in a nutshell, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, is that there's a finite amount of ground out there for production of agricultural commodities. And when you give an advantage through a tax credit, which already has a federal tax subsidy for production of corn, you give an additional incentive to move that ground from alfalfa, for example, which the dairy industry consumes a lot of alfalfa hay, comes from two places that can grow corn, the Columbia Basin and Ontario, other and Klamath Falls I heard mentioned. You give a tax subsidy to one purchaser or one pursuer of that ground, then the other pursuer of that ground is disadvantaged, and then you raise the cost of production in the state of Oregon to dairy producers, livestock feeders, and when we compete with Idaho milk and Washington milk and California milk coming into the state from various things. Our cost of production goes up. We have to compete with those other states, and so that's where the disadvantage comes in. I don't think there was any intention of that occurring, but it simply will occur because it's simply producing corn, for example, in the Columbia Basin is a one-harvest thing. If you're producing alfalfa, you have to harvest it four times, and so your cost of production goes up. And so your cost of production producing alfalfa is higher because of the greater manipulation of that crop that you have to do than with grain corn. So if it's more profitable for the grower to produce grain corn and sell it to the ethanol plant in Hermiston, then I support him doing that. But it's a market that's created artificially with the 90-cent per bushel tax subsidy that's given to them and not to the grain, to the livestock producer or dairyman here in the state. So that's the nutshell of the issue. The most equitable thing would be for the 90-cent tax credit to go away and rely on the federal tax subsidy so all states are on a parity. And all that subsidy has been adequate to generate corn production for ethanol producers. I don't know that the 90 cents really brings, additional. You're still going to get a lot of corn on the unit trains from the Midwest, as Senator Monroe indicates. But still there's going to be this dislocation of feed production and increased cost to the livestock industries here in the state of Oregon.
Thank you. Senator George.
Dave, Capital Press, probably about 6 months ago, had an article, and in that article, if I understood it correctly, it said that if you took the entire production of the Midwest, that you produce about 10.3% of the total energy for automobiles and trucks that we needed. So we may be doing a lot for a very little amount. But there is the other side of the equation, and that is because of set-aside programs over the, government incentive programs to stop farming ground, and we paid a lot of people a lot of money to stop doing it, it might be time to lift those and get that ground back into production. Because a few years ago, we were on a trip that began here in Oregon, and it ended up, we went east and then down through Colorado into Texas and then back up through New Mexico and Arizona into California. And the thing that was noted was that everywhere we went, you saw farm ground that had been farmed that was currently out of production. The potential to bring production back in levels the playing field as far as we know what the price is going to be. But the question is there the willingness, and I'm asking you folks because I think you would have the best handle on this, is there a willingness to bring that ground back into production? Because it may include developing additional water sources. We're talking irrigation here, folks. And are we willing to make those kind of trade-offs to get that ground into production for the production of fuel and livestock feed?
Mr. Chairman, Senator George, I think that's an astute observation. I think the issue you're talking about is conservation reserve plantings all across the Midwest and the West. And obviously the Midwest has weekly irrigation from thunderstorms that we don't have here. And so we can grow dryland crops. We don't have, you know, corn needs water, simply put. And so without it, so our concern is that the irrigated ground that exists, I don't think there's going to be any new, you've heard of the Oasis project, I'm sure, and I don't see that moving very rapidly through the process to bring additional waters from the Columbia River to bear in northeastern Oregon where you can grow these things. So I don't see that as being a big thing. So we see not additional ground coming into production because of that water limitation. We're not going to have any more water here in the Willamette Valley, and we don't have the climate to grow grain corn here in the Willamette Valley. So I think what you're going to see is the dislocation of, or the reallocation of acres that are the highest return to the individual grower.
I need to keep us moving so that we've got a couple folks who've come 400 and 250 miles away, so I'm going to make sure we get them in.
They're much more knowledgeable than I.
Well, definitely me then. Yes, sir.
Yeah, Senator Decker, members of the committee, my name is Jim Cron. I'm the executive director for the Oregon Dairy Farmers Association. Just a couple things, and to play off kind of what the two people previous to me stated. In our March newsletter that we send to all of you, and I'm sure each of you have read it in detail, and have it at your fingertips. It describes very clearly what occurred on the national perspective and as far as the 54 cent a gallon tax credit that's given presently. That process just in the year 2006 increased feed costs to the dairy industry by 32% in the state of Oregon. 32%. That's somewhere between 50 and 60% of the cost of that dairy operation. That's gigantic. We've never seen anything like that in the past. I think it's important also that if you reference that newsletter, we did talk about being aware of unintended consequences that may occur with doing these types of things. I think it's very important for you to understand a little bit when we feed a cow a diet we call the ration. There are really three major parts of that ration. One is energy, that's corn. Two is protein, that's alfalfa, and soybean, for example. And number three is fiber. Fiber comes from corn silage and alfalfa to an extent. The concern that we have, and we're already seeing it, we already have producers being told that someone is not going to grow corn silage for them. They're going to grow a higher end value crop. Now, obviously, those things occur, and we're aware of that, but that's also happening on the sweet corn side. And so dairy producers use to a very high volume the waste products from the sweet corn processing side, again, as a fiber to their ration. And we're extremely concerned about this removal, especially if we prop it up again. And again, we believe that the dairy industry needs to be made whole on this issue if it's going to cost them. And in addition, we would surely recommend some sort of economic analysis to determine how this would impact the dairy industry, because obviously we have dairies that are going to be located right next to plants. We have dairies that are in Coos Bay. We have dairies in Tillamook. And we can make guesstimates on how this will impact them, and we don't think it's going to be positive. But to the highest level, we don't know. And so surely this needs to be fixed, and surely before any tax credit was given on this side, there needs to be an economic analysis done to determine what that impact would be. Thank you very much.
Great, thank you. You are now signed up as proponents of of this legislation. So now we'll hear from the opponents.
Well, we are supporting renewable energy.
Kind of.
Try to ferret out the support in there. Bergstein, do you have a panel? Okay, so John Wilson, he's on the list. And Jim Welsh. Okay, and we'll hear from the cattlemen, and then we'll get to the proponents. Well, hopefully you'll be as enthusiastic as the last proponents were. And then so Larry Price, I don't have you on 2210, but I do have you at a distance. So if you let our staff know if you want to testify on 2210, we'll work you in since you came from a distance. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, Senators. My name's John Wilson. I'm a fifth-generation Oregon rancher. I represent my own company, Beef Northwest Feeders, as well as the cattle feeding industry in Oregon. I also represent the Oregon Country Beef Cooperative, which is made up of 100 different ranchers throughout the state. It's probably the most successful cooperative in the United States today of ranchers. I'd like to start by saying we do support Oregon's move towards alternative fuels, and we support the policies in House Bill 2210. We have a problem with the 90-cent per bushel tax credit in Section 5, Subsection 2. It will harm our industry. Currently, corn prices are $3.60 a bushel. This proposed tax credit is 25% the value of the current value of corn. It simply would assure that no farmer in Oregon could afford to sell corn to the livestock industry. It disrupts the market forces, and it seriously jeopardizes a $250 million feeding industry in the state. Our neighboring states don't have a single state tax credit like this, and we simply couldn't compete with them. To answer, I believe it was Senator Monroe's question earlier, there are 29,000 acres of feed corn in the state that produce about 5.2 million bushels. If we added the annual demand from the livestock feeding industry with the new demand from a ethanol plant that's going into the Port of Morrow, we would need over 200,000 acres planted to corn versus the current 29,000 acres. Those acres aren't available in Oregon. It simply would not happen. We would remain a corn deficit state, and our industry would be at a tremendous disadvantage in the purchasing of grains in the state. We do support the biofuel industry. We just cannot allow this type of tax credit to ruin our industry at the expense of that. We would like to have some sort of parity. And our solution would be to eliminate the tax credits for grain. If not, the livestock industry has to have a degree of parity with anybody else that's purchasing grains in the state. We don't want to be the unintended collateral damage from this tax credit. And we're simply here today to try to state that fact and answer any questions. I appreciate the time.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Wilson. Senator George.
Question. In the past, we've always heard that the byproducts coming out of an alcohol generator is really good feedstock. Is it or is it not? I mean, do you end up with a product that can be put back into the livestock chain?
Senator, we can. It's about a 1 to 10 balance, though, unfortunately. If it were 1 to 1, we probably wouldn't be here today, but it doesn't fit particularly into the livestock feeding industry. It will work a little bit more for the dairy industry, I believe, but even with them, it's not anywhere close to 1 to 1. The starches and energies that we need are sucked out. That's what goes into the ethanol.
Jim, anything that we've missed on the cattle front?
Mr. Chair and committee members, Jim Welsh, here representing Oregon Cattlemen Association. You've heard all about the 2210 and Section 5, Sub 2. And I'm not going to cover the unintended consequences here other than what we have been doing to educate people on those. We're here with our hat in hand, and we were not giving testimony on this issue on the House side. We apologize for that and coming in late. It's one of those things that happens. And no excuses, we just weren't there. We're not trying to stop this bill. We want to make sure people understand that. We've been trying to communicate with everyone on this issue and getting as much information out to everyone why this particular tax credit is going to cause a problem within our industry. Okay, I've given you my testimony here. You can follow through all of that. I think it aligns very closely with what you've heard from Farm Bureau and from the dairymen in every way. I just want to mention very quickly that the parity that we're asking for is extremely important. We know that now. And we know that if we're the collateral damage, as John has said, that we're going to see that lovely juicy steak that you so enjoy being increased in price. If not, it'll be coming from Canada, it'll be coming from Brazil, Argentina, and you won't see this industry flourishing much at all. So we have some real concerns. We're hoping that we can, what we've asked for here is, and there's a number of possibilities. If you don't want to amend this bill, and I understand the reluctance to do that because we've talked to the parties about it, we're not being that specific in wanting to amend this bill. If you don't want to open it up, fine. We have other vehicles. There's relating clauses available, and I have plenty of priority bills available for members also. So we could put in the language that we need and bring this back and get approval from leadership. We're trying to gain that as we go through, and certainly approval from our industry and associated industries.
Great. Thank you very much, Mr. Wells. Thank you, Mr. Wilson. We are going to be right up against the clock, and I want to make sure folks have come from a distance.
We want to try to get as many folks in as we can before floor session.
They're up. They're moving towards the podium, and Gallagher is not one of them. Who came from? He came from about 10 miles. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, Senators. My name is Laurie Price. I farm in Malheur County, along the banks of the Snake River, so I'm adjacent right to the Idaho line. What excites me about this bill, I've been following it last session and talking about the 90-cent tax credit, its implementation as to what was there before last session. This has the KISS system. Keep it simple, stupid. You know, it's very simple, easy to understand, growers can understand it. What excites me in Malheur County is the placement of a ethanol biorefinery that will use barley and wheat. And that's why I want to keep the tax credit there. This facility is twofold. It's used for human consumption, and what's not used for human consumption goes into the waste treatment center, which becomes ethanol. Very unique to most other operations. The real key one they're going after is beta-glucan. Beta-glucan has been proven by USDA. If you take 3 ounces, that's basically 2 to 3 teaspoons a day, you'll drop your cholesterol 17%. I've done it. I dropped my cholesterol 13% with no other changes, and dropped my triglycerides 30%. Has nothing to do with ethanol, but it has to do with the driving of this whole system, because this facility started out as an ethanol plant. These individuals have looked outside the box and looking at the full picture, and so what I see in Malheur County, this facility potentially will use 40,000 acres of barley, 48,000 acres of wheat. Knowing it won't all come from Oregon, it'll come from Idaho. But my concern is that we maintain a competitive advantage over our competitors in Idaho. All our costs have gone up, fuel, fertilizer, and the like. Along with it, in my neck of the woods, I compete with minimum wage standards across the line that are lowest in the nation, regulations that are lower. My concern is that the production stays in Oregon into that Oregon facility. Originally, that facility was going to be placed in Idaho because of political pressures. That got shifted to Oregon. Yay. And I'm excited about that part of it. These barleys and wheats that they're going to use are not normal use barleys and wheats. They're waxy wheats, waxy barleys. There's very limited supplies of them, very little supply in the seed stocks. I'm a seedman. I sell seed, raise alfalfa seed, corn seed, not corn seed, wheat seed and barley seed. This industry needs to be jump-started. These incentives will help that. There's some really big risks that me as a seed handler is going to have to take, and there's some real potentials that these tax credits will help offset that. The other avenue is the growers in my area have to think differently as to how they handle their product. Right now, they harvest it, send it to the warehouse, and they send it downriver immediately after harvest. These facilities will be requiring them to market it totally differently. There's very little on-farm storage in Malheur County. So that's going to be a need. 2211 allows for that on-farm storage production facilities, and
I mean, I just see, you know, 2012, that's not very far out. You know, this whole thing is sunset. I'm looking 3 years out on seed production that will even get to the grower to potentially get those tax credits. So I don't see that there's going to be a major impact with wheat and barley coming into affecting the cattle industry. And that's why I'd really like you to keep the 90-cent tax credit for those industries. What has not been addressed, and down the road, you as representatives of the senators, we're going to have to look at what we do with research. There's no research clauses in this in any of these packages. And there's a lot of questions asked to production questions with a lot of these new products. So, you know, whether it be the wheats or canolas or even soybeans. And Malheur County's experiment station's been looking at soybeans for the last basically 15 years. And the question is, could we use soybeans in biodiesel? So we're very supportive of the Oregon Wheat Growers League, and we really appreciate that you highly consider that tax credit for wheat and barley.
Thank you. Thanks for traveling to the Capitol this morning. Yes, sir.
Mr. Chairman, I'm committee. I'm Mike Noonan from Klamath Falls, Oregon. I'm president of the Oregon Wheat Growers and have a lot of cattle, too. So I've thought a lot about this issue, and the biggest thing that I can see that I really think we can focus on, because a guy could go on with a lot of concerns, but one thing's for sure is Oregon seems ready to move forward with renewable energy. And with that being said, we as wheat producers, we also represent barley, rye, and triticale. But what we don't represent is corn. And all the dairymen plus most of the cattle feeders here are all bringing to your attention the price of corn. I think corn should be deleted as far as the 90 cents for the 90 cents per bushel tax credit. That will alleviate most of their feed issues. Wheat is not a primary use for that. I think it'd be very easy to get rid of corn and very easy and agreeable on. The second issue is we want to make sure that Oregon farmers maintain a competitive advantage. If this bill, if Oregon's going to be the leader in renewable fuels, we as farmers and wheat farmers want to make sure that we're taking an active part in that. The tax credit will ensure that. At this point, without the tax credit, I wouldn't look for a lot of participation. Just wouldn't be there in the countryside, given the newfound extra opportunity since the price of corn and ethanol has went up. Everything else has went up too. So the next 5 years are very important to get our feet on the ground and help fuel this renewable energy move within the state of Oregon.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Thank you very much. Appreciate the testimony. Let's go. We've got time for... We're
going to have to be quick. We have time for a couple more panels, so we'll do Brian Doherty, Tom Gallagher, John Charles is one panel. Then we'll do Tom Endicott. You're not usually here, are you?
No.
Okay, so we'll have you. These guys will be really quick. They're here all the time. And billing every second of it.
Yeah, I wish...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Brian Doherty of the Miller National Law Firm, representing the Western States Petroleum Association. And yes, I do think it's a great idea to have people up here on retainer. And if I could get all the things that this industry has gotten for incentives and mandates, I'd be in a great shape as a lobbyist, too. First of all, what I wanted to say was, to turn a phrase, as the Irish often do, I come to praise Caesar, not to bury him. And I mean this about 2210. We are the number one blenders of ethanol in the world. We are the number one blenders of biodiesel in the world, our companies. We are in this industry. So the rumors aside, we are going down this road. But I'd like to point out some things that deal with some of your incentives. The majority of this bill we do support. We have opposed mandates. You'll hear more from Mr. Charles about why we oppose mandates in general. And we are the ones that get the tax credit on ethanol and the federal and on biodiesel. And we're still here, if you want to call it a statement against interest. We get that blending credit. What I want to talk about is ethanol from corn for a moment, and you've just heard a lot of this, and we're talking about incenting an industry that's not a fledgling industry. You've heard the problems that it creates and collateral consequences. We are not investing in corn-based ethanol. We are investing in cellulosic ethanol. You heard Chevron just announce a partnership with Weyerhaeuser to look at cellulosic ethanol. You've heard Chevron is also blending. The largest biodiesel plant will be opening in Texas that Chevron is opening. You have the other companies are doing the same thing. I don't understand this corn incentive. It is a 5 billion gallon a year business. We're blending that much in biofuels already. So it is something that I think on the economics, on the math, and on the science, it doesn't make sense. On the economics, you have right now saying you want to have energy independence. Yet the studies, from the best to the worst, show that you're using at least essentially 1 gallon of fossil fuel to make 1 gallon of ethanol. On the math, corn is a food staple. You're hearing it now. Cellulosic is not. And cellulosic is what Oregonians can grow. And corn will never compete with Oregon corn will never compete with the Midwest. What we hear, 29,000 acres of corn in Oregon. Iowa alone has over 12 million acres in corn production, and it's growing all through the Midwest. You're not going to do it. Why are we incentivizing a crop that will not help Oregon farmers? I don't get it. What we have done on the biodiesel side has been very smart. We said, we're going to give you this if you have 4 million gallons of biodiesel production in Oregon from Northwest feedstocks, we'll trigger this mandate. We don't have that in ethanol. We're going to have a trigger on this ethanol based on a capacity, not on production. And it'll have nothing to do with Northwest feedstocks. It'll have all to do with Midwest feedstocks, because that's where it's going to come. You know, corn is the kingdom, and Midwest is the king. This is where it's all going to be coming from. The solution is cellulosic, and I think that's what you ought to be looking at in this. And if you did that, you'd have an incentive based on Northwest feedstocks, and you'd have it where Oregon farmers can compete and go forward. We are going to be selling this product no matter what it is, and we're going to be selling whatever product is coming along in 2030. We're here to work on this. We've worked a lot on this bill, but I think there's some points I want to make that it hadn't. I'm going to end it now because I think Tom Gallagher can address one of the concerns about this quick trigger on ethanol and what may happen in eastern Oregon. But I'd be happy to answer any questions now or later if you have any on anything I've testified to today. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Doherty. Keeping our all-Irish panel going, Mr. Gallagher.
I believe Mr. Charles is weighing in on the Irish panel. Members of the committee, my name is Tom Gallagher. I'm here today representing Chevron USA, and I'm going to pass out a letter to you that Chevron sent back to all the people we briefed in April when we came in and talked about a problem I'm just going to highlight. We're going to use every public opportunity not to seek to amend the bill, but to say that the Chevron terminals in Pasco and Kennewick will not be up to speed to produce blended ethanol fuel for eastern Oregon as of the date of the trigger in this bill. That decision was made in the Senate Environment Committee to go ahead regardless of that. But I just want to point out to you that we're still on the schedule that we predicted 2 months ago as to upgrading our terminal facilities, and we predict that they're... Let me read the exact language of the letter for you. Without allowing that 210's anticipated trigger remains unchanged, without allowing adequate transition time to address the infrastructure and logistical challenges, operation at Pasco and Boise terminals may be disrupted, and the levels of gasoline product deliveries into eastern Oregon may be negatively impacted. In such a scenario, it is not at all clear that the remaining Oregon gasoline distribution system can make up for the potential shortfalls in eastern Oregon. So that section language is in Section 17, and I know you don't do substantive amendments in this committee, Mr. Chair, so I'll pass it on to the Irish, Mr. Charles.
So Tom, just on where are we at with the AG's opinion in terms of if the facility's not up and running and the governor's ability when the legislature's not in session to at least deal with ensuring that fuel supply that we don't get a potential problem in terms of fuel supply.
Approximately 4.5 million gallons a month are pulled out of the Chevron facilities. That's a small percentage of the fuel in Oregon. I have no ability to tell you how that marketing piece will be fixed. It can be. Normally in fuel disruptions like this, one way it's fixed is price. Fuel follows the price. And
aren't we waiting for, and maybe someone from the Department of Justice is here.
Chair Decker, Brian Doherty again. I might say Dave Vanthoff has asked, or at least the governor's office, he's told me the governor's office, has asked the attorney general for opinion about whether the governor has the authority to temporarily and geographically suspend the mandate in this situation where you'd have a merchant terminal in two out-of-state locations that can't supply this 4.5 million gallons a month. And we have not heard back as of this morning. Mr. Vanthoff had not heard back, is what he had told me. And I think it's important to know if that can do it, because I think we're going to see that if the trigger is in the fourth quarter of 07 or first quarter of 08, certainly.
So, Dave, if we could, he's whispering to his name. So if we could just get some sense of where the Attorney General comes down on that question. Mr. Charles.
Hey, Mr. Chairman, John Charles, President of Cascade Policy Institute, and I am half Irish, so I think I deserve to be at the table here. I'm opposed to the entire biofuels package, and especially to sections 14 and 18 of House Bill 2210, the fuels mandates. I think those are particularly bad ideas, and I did raise these objections in the House Environment and Energy Committee many months ago. Mr. Chairman, you've asked several times today, why can't biofuels entrepreneurs simply compete in the marketplace without these distortions? And I think the simple answer here, and you hear this repeatedly, frankly, in other contexts, is because they'd rather have these subsidies, they'd rather make money through some kind of cartel arrangement than to compete in the marketplace. I mean, that's the easy answer. And but you've been sitting here for an hour, so you know the complexity of this, and the problem is there's no single person in this room who totally understands everything about the market. There are people here who are experts about part of the market. So you run into the problem of unintended consequences, and they want you to pretend that you know all these things and pass this very convoluted set of schemes that will pick winners and losers. And the problem is that the track record, especially in technology innovation, for picking winners is extremely poor over history, not just in the public sector, but in the private sector. And, of course, when people lose private money doing it, well, that's market discipline. When you lose public money, that's a different story. Now, some cases are kind of humorous, such as Jack Kilby, who was the co-inventor of the integrated circuit in 1958. But as he said in his autobiography, for several years after that, when he went to technical conferences, his microprocessor was the subject of much humor at conferences, as he was basically laughed out of the room. And companies who could have been early adopters, such as Westinghouse in Slovenia, passed on helping to usher in the digital era. And, well, you know, they missed out on billions of dollars. And in 2000, Mr. Kilby was awarded the Nobel Prize in Physics. Okay, well, maybe no harm done. But in others' context, it's much more sobering picture. In the 1960s and 70s, the federal government spent billions of dollars subsidizing the SST Concord, the Clinch River Breeder Reactor, Jimmy Carter's Sinfuels Corporation, and today we have what to show for all of that? Nothing. sometimes we're tragically wrong. I started my career 30 years ago working for an environmental group, the Environmental Defense Fund, which led the litigation charge against DDT. And if you were a newbie at EDF, you were always given the whole story about how they helped persuade William Ruckelshaus, the much-admired EPA administrator, to ban DDT, even though his own hearings officer, after taking testimony all across the country, recommended DDT not be banned, that there was no evidence of carcinogenicity. Well, now, it turns out, 35 years later, tens of millions of people have died, mostly in sub-Saharan Africa, from the lack of DDT, and even the World Health Organization, as of last October, finally came around to bringing DDT back in the mix as a politically acceptable use of controlling malaria. And so, for me, I find it very sobering, very humbling, that the attitude of my environmental colleagues 30 years ago, in fact, up until probably a few years ago, was that this was a great intervention as a market failure corrected by government to ban DDT. Well, if you've killed tens of millions of people, shouldn't you learn from that experience? So my conclusion about these bills is that, frankly, the proponents of them, in some sense, really don't like to compete, and they want you to help jumpstart an industry so that they can reap financial rewards that they would never actually earn in the marketplace. And I encourage you to not be the enablers of this dysfunctional behavior, to simply back out and let the market itself pick the winners and losers, because our ability to prospectively do that is very limited. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Charles?
Just a quick question.
Yeah, please.
John, you hit on something that I thought about in the beginning. If the feedstock, you know, for alcohol production is in the Midwest, it's a lot easier to process it there, put the alcohol in a tanker and ship it there. Any comment on that? It seemed like, if you know, they have a functioning operation. We don't have the, nobody's going to allow us to, we're not going to be able to get the water we need to bring into production all the grass. So would it make more sense to allow an existing industry to produce the alcohol and bring it here for us?
I think you have to allow markets to work. To the extent that there are distortions that already disproportionately reward someone or allow a negative externality, I think correcting that might be a good idea. But otherwise, I think fundamentally, the potential here is to be played by certain lobbyists for their own gain, and the public interest, what's the public interest? I'm not seeing it.
So we're short on time, but can I take a swing at that? We had the president of the wheat growers just prior. Mm-hmm. Say a couple things. One is he's not going to get into this without some sort of incentive. And then at the state level, we're having to make decisions, you know, in a competitive 50-state plus global environment where if you look at other countries, they just straight up subsidize just about any economic development activity, just put money into it. And so how is a state to compete where you've got Idaho, you've got other states Washington giving large incentives, and for us to, I guess, take a more pure stand that we're just not going to engage at all, do you think there at least would be some detriment to that state that takes that course, where other states are saying to that president of the wheat growers, we're going to provide a little incentive because there's an environmental benefit and also an economic development benefit?
Mr. Chairman, I think the entire economic history of the world shows that tariffs and subsidies are dysfunctional. They actually destroy wealth. And notwithstanding what others are doing, I think actually disarming by ourselves, you might say, makes sense, because if you don't subsidize, if you allow markets to function, then capital goes to where it is most rewarded, and you help create wealth. Because other states, other countries may think they're creating wealth, they're destroying wealth. And the faster somebody figures out getting off of that Ferris wheel and gets in the business of creating wealth, the better your constituents will be.
China seems to be doing okay, at least in the last 5 years. But thank you very, very much. Lindsay Capps, Tim Raphael, Tom Endicott, Charles Carson, Carlson, and I have to go briefly.
Sure, absolutely.
I'll highlight the ones we haven't got.
Okay.
What are you guys?
Good morning. Yeah. Chair Decker and members of the committee, I'm Thomas Endicott, representing Sequential Biofuels and Sequential Pacific Biodiesel. You may know Sequential Biofuels is the largest retailer of biodiesel in Oregon and very possibly in the country. Sequential Pacific Biodiesel is the only operating commercial biofuels production facility in Oregon. Today, we produce 1 million gallons per year of biodiesel from used cooking oil and Oregon-grown canola just a few miles from here on Kubler Boulevard in Salem. I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 2210, and several of you have seen my face around the building here. Since we're here in revenue, specifically on the issue of the tax credit, I was a member of the Renewable Energy Work Group Biofuel Subcommittee. I've been involved in this discussion since fall of 2002, and I want to tell you this is a very good bill. On the issue of the credit as it relates to corn and the credits, the producer tax credits in general, the purpose of these credits was, as Representative Dingfelder mentioned, to jumpstart the industry. And what that means in a state that really has no biofuels industry, a very small one to date, means leveling the playing field with Midwest corn producers and ethanol and biodiesel producers and with Canadian canola producers. So what these credits were intended to do was help give a leg up to crops that are already produced in Oregon. Now, that said, if you look into the language in the bill in Section 5, for the grain crops, including but not limited to wheat, barley, and triticale. Now, we weren't even thinking about corn when we put this together. So I'll leave it there to say that we have no problem in removing corn from that part of the production tax credit. However, on wheat, barley, and triticale, we do believe that there is an opportunity for those crops to be converted into ethanol. And I think that you just heard a grower from Mount Hare County mention that this is a possibility at a facility there in Mount Hare County. The other point I want to make here is we're clearly competing against the biofuels industry in the Midwest, and biofuels are a replacement fuel. They replace gas and diesel fuel. Of course, Oregon has no petroleum refineries. We have no oil wells here, and yet we spend over $10 million a day on gas and diesel that effectively leaves the state. Sequential Pacific Biodiesel, the production facility here, Cascade Grain, Pacific Ethanol, those are Oregon-based companies, not refineries based in Washington or based in California. And certainly we appreciate their ability to send the petroleum-based fuels into the state because we rely on those fuels. But these facilities in this state will keep money and jobs in the state, and that's what House Bill 2210 has been about since the beginning. So bottom line, this is to jumpstart the industry, help the growers participate in Oregon to capture some of that wealth, help the jobs and the economic development and companies to be situated here. So I urge you to support this bill, and I understand the action that you may need to take on the corn inclusion in the production feedstock tax credit, but everyone in this room and outside in the halls here knows the importance of this bill and knows that this is a session that this bill needs to pass. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, Senator George is going to take over because I have to go. One question, Tom, and I know you can't speak for all the community that's been working and advocating, is do you think there's near unanimity on taking corn out?
I can tell you that I believe in the discussion around that particular grain in this bill. Most of those people were in this room, and I would say that there is agreement that that would be the case. You will hear from them if there's not after this session, but I would believe that that's the case.
That's why you're leaving me.
You make that decision.
Okay. All right. State your name for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Charles Carlson. I'm the CEO of Cascade Grain Products. We're a 113 million gallon year ethanol plant that will be producing in the first quarter of 2008. We're well into our construction. Pacific Ethanol will be able to provide a 10% ethanol blend for the state of Oregon. What we will be using, yes, corn is our feedstock. We expect the majority of our corn to come from the Midwest. We'll be coming in 110 car shuttle trains. We will be producing distiller dry grains for the local dairy and the livestock, remaining livestock industry. It's a high protein product. It is being brought into the area right now. It will allow us to produce it here locally, to distribute it locally. When they say, why are we trying to get it for a 10% blend and why do we need the mandate, there is not free access into the petroleum industry. You see it down in Brazil where they've gone with 25% mandates, and you have there 31,000 stations, and those 31,000 stations also carry alcohol. Here in the U.S., we have roughly 171,000 stations, and there's about 1,000 that contain E85. So the easiest way into this market, to ensure market, is through a 10% blend, because that's the way it's open to us with the franchise agreements that the local station operators have with the petroleum industry. It is difficult to break into there. There was a very good article in the Wall Street Journal on that, and one of the reasons why we need to have mandated blends to get into that industry. But I ask you to support House Bill 2210 to push it on. I think this is a session that we need to have this bill, and it'll be a way to start cellulosic ethanol, which, yes, is the future for ethanol to grow beyond a 10% blend, because we are limited by grain. Whether that comes from municipal solid waste, whether it comes from ag residue, forestry residue, those are those kind of things that are going to allow us to gain more ethanol to the point where they talk about the 35 to 55 billion gallons that we have that capability of, so we can make a significant dent in the amount of crude oil that we have to import into this United States. You know, we have a globe that's similar to that water cooler over there. It only holds so much crude oil, and it's getting emptied every day. At some point in time, we have to look to renewables to replace a portion of that, even if it just to extend it a few generations beyond what we could now if we were strictly using crude in order to come up with alternative methods for our transportation.
Mr. Vice Chair, Senator Starr, Lindsey Capps, Legislative Director for the Oregon Environmental Council. I was also a member of the Biofuel Subcommittee of the Renewable Energy Working Group. And there's been obviously a broad coalition working on this issue for quite a while to put together a package that I think, bottom line, provides benefits for all of Oregon. Obviously, this pursues a multiple set of goals, obviously energy independence, stronger rural economy and strong agricultural sector, and obviously promoting healthier communities in our state by having cleaner fuels that reduce air toxics and reduce global warming pollution in the state. The tax credits in HB 2210 and 2211 really go hand in hand with the renewable fuel standard that's triggered by local feedstock production. These will help to provide a stable market for Oregon growers and Oregon businesses that invest in these types of clean fuel technologies and renewable fuels. Obviously, our goal here is to try to get away from foreign fossil fuels that are non-renewable, continue to cost us more at the pump, which affects our economy, and put our economy and our security at risk. With feedstock production in Oregon and the region, I think we'll see a continual supply of cleaner renewable fuel that can stabilize our local energy needs. And greater biofuels production goes hand in hand with increased fuel efficiency, greater energy conservation, new cleaner fuel technologies. And we believe that production ought to be geared toward those feedstocks and emerging technologies where our state can leverage the greatest economic benefit and competitive advantage, as well as environmental benefits. And so that's, we're talking about things like biodiesel, obviously, about cellulosic ethanol that can be made from a broad diversity of feedstocks that we can produce in Oregon. And we believe that 2210 and 2211 are a means of putting us on that path. So we encourage the committee's support for those bills, and thank you for the time today.
Okay, thank you. Okay, thank you very much. It looks like Dan Charles Lindstrom and Lisa Adulto and Ernie Munch. Am I going to get the names right? If not, correct me quickly.
I'm going to leave.
You're going to have to go? I pay attention and then I transfer to them.
Vice Chair and committee members, don't really have anything to say except I hope you get it right.
Okay.
I do know that.
Oh, yes, we need your name for
that. Dan Lindstrom.
Okay.
Excuse me. Born in Prineville, Oregon. And, I realize all the information that you're getting today is all critically important. I know if I was rich and none of the tax credits were available, if I knew there was money there, I'd build a biomass plant. But so I hope you get it right, because you guys are changing laws every day here in Salem. So,
well, I think that's a legitimate point. We've had a lot of concern about, well, are we making a mistake? Are we going to get out of balance? We're going to be back here in a year, and we're going to be probably an annual session. So my feeling about any tweaks that we may need to do in the bill, we'll adjust those in the future. So I think you're right. We just need to really pay attention to what happens when these incentives go out. Would you agree with that? Or
yes.
Okay. All right. Thanks.
Go ahead.
My name is Lisa Adato, and I work for the Oregon Business Association, and I appreciate the chance to testify, and I'll go really quickly. I'm not going to add a lot to what's been said. We, the Oregon Business Association, is a statewide organization made up of a variety of kind of businesses, not a particular interest group. Our purpose is to create prosperity in Oregon, and we have a very a lengthy vetting process for bills, and we have a committee that has reviewed this a number of times, and then it goes to our board of directors, and our committee chose the biofuels bill as the number one bill to support in Oregon, and generally we think that it will bring prosperity to Oregon, and both in the east and the west, urban and rural. We also wanted to point out that it's consistent with the Oregon business plan, which is to promote sustainability. We see that as a competitive advantage for Oregon. So not only are we competing with Idaho because they're there and we're here, but Oregon has chosen sustainability as something to really highlight as a market enhancer for our state, and this is an important part of that. We do want to point out, though, it's not the panacea. This is still a first step in a long march to creating energy independence and reducing some of the global warming pollution. So we think we support it strongly. We'd like to see you make the fixes that are necessary that were discussed here. And I'll end there. Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks very much.
Yes. Senator George, my name is Ernie Munch, and yes. I signed up to testify on 2211. I don't know if this is appropriate.
Well, yes, you did, but the chairman gave me the list with you on it. Why don't you go ahead and testify to that bill?
All right. I'm an architect. My address is 111 Southwest Oak in Portland, and I'm here representing myself and also two clients, the Stoller Family Winery in mm-hmm. Dayton, and also the Portland Rehabilitation Center in Portland. Portland Rehabilitation Center is a nonprofit, self-sustaining. They're building a large building now, and they want to put on that a solar array, which will be 870 kilowatts, which is very large. It's six or seven times as large as what is in the Northwest now. And we are here to support House Bill 2211, which will raise the business energy tax credit from 35% to 50%. We've been working on this for about 9 months to a year. The building is almost complete. We're ready to put the solar array on. We're closing in on the financing now. And we have four, maybe five parties that are interested in investing in the product, in the project, but at a 50% rate. And we think that that will probably disappear if it's kept at 35%. So it's very important to us. Nothing will be signed on this project until the governor signs this bill.
Hmm.
If you have any questions, I'd be pleased to answer.
Well, I think it's an important issue. You know, we're talking about Oregon, the green, sustainable. I think it fits well with our tourism pitch. I think there's a lot of things that can make this thing work for Oregonians, and I see a real potential in these bills to, as you pointed out, Lisa, to benefit both the east side and the west side. So. Appreciate your testimony. I wish I had more people here. A record is being made, and you are going out on the internet, so every contact's valuable.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you, guys. Do we have anyone else who was unable to speak? Come on up.
Thank you, Senator George. For the record, Tim Raphael with Pacific Ethanol. Chair Deckard mentioned my name, but then another panel filled the chairs. Very briefly, I would echo the comments of Thomas Endicott and Chuck Carlson in support of the bill and its many benefits to the economy and environment of Oregon. Additionally, I just wanted to respond to one of the previous comments made here and strenuously object to the idea that somehow our ethanol facility or others are in direct competition with cattle feeders or dairies in Oregon. Pacific Ethanol is building a plant in Boardman, Oregon that will open July 1 of this year, and we are not in that location by accident. All of our plants are being built near cows because one of the key co-products to ethanol is a distiller's grain, which has been a high-value, high-protein supplement for both the dairy and beef industries, and a very popular product, I might add, coming coming out of our plants in Madera, California, and Windsor, Colorado. We predict that will be also be the case here with our Boardman facility. For that reason, I believe that some of the concerns about the corn incentive have in fact neglected a few of the other side of the equation that could in fact reduce feed prices for livestock growers in the state. The other being that Pacific Ethanol has invested in 1 million bushels of grain storage capacity and truck and rail infrastructure at the Boardman plant, which is adjacent to the largest feedlot and dairy in the state. That will reduce transportation costs for a substantial amount of potential feed for those operations, and we believe presents a great opportunity for them to lower their costs for inputs. And we're excited to be locating where we are and to be business partners with agriculture in Oregon. With that said, we are highly supportive of the bill and look forward to working with you on its passage.
Tim, I really appreciate that because I see former Representative Jeff Krupp at the back. And as agriculturalists, and when we were in college, we learned about a miraculous process called fermentation. And what's amazing is you get a conversion of a cellulosic product into a brand new form. And many times it's much more digestible. The TDN, total digestible nutrients, go up. A lot of beneficial things. I've always assumed what you said was the case, that this might in fact be a benefit to livestock producers in Oregon.
Thank you, Senator George. That certainly is proven to be the case at our other locations, and we think it'll be true here. We believe that the incentive and the range of incentives, we don't see corn as any different than the other feedstocks that are being incentivized in this bill. And in fact, the extent to which that encourages more acreage of corn in Oregon and increases the supply for both feeders and for ethanol, that's a good thing for all consumers of the product. We face the same vagaries of the national market on corn price. This incentive, the day after this incentive was in place, I don't think you see anything happen to the price of corn. That's set in Chicago. Mm-hmm. What you do see is an added incentive for Oregon farmers to be able to compete with the Midwest, and we think that's a good thing for all involved. So well, thank you.
And John Charles mentioned something, and that is the market, which is absolutely critical. But I don't know if you watch RFD TV, but if you do watch RFD TV, you watch the Ag Report, and one of the things you're noticing, there's a massive change in the Midwest to bring additional corn acreage into production. So I think there will be a pretty rapid leveling of the price of the product. In the Madera plant, my question for you is, is the San Joaquin Valley grown product, or do you actually bring in corn too into that facility?
Senator George, thanks for the question. We use about 13 million bushels of corn a year in our operation in Madera, and likewise in Boardman. We are set up with, as Chuck Carlson's parent, bringing unit trains from the Midwest. We're also buying some local product here and there, and would hope to do so in Oregon as well. It helps the sustainability of the operation, helps our efficiencies, obviously. But it's not our intention, and we recognize clearly that product will not ever all come from Oregon. We think that increasing the local supply is good for price for all of those involved.
I'm going to ask this question even though we're running out of time, and this is it. Are the mandates in California requiring that a certain percentage be blended? Is that the reason you're there? Do you think it's necessary for Oregon?
It's a slightly different market there. You have what's happened in California is the replacement of MTBE, which was a dangerous drinking water contaminant used to as an oxygen for clean air purposes in California, has been replaced with ethanol as a clean burning alternative for air quality reasons. That's made California the largest market in the country for ethanol. In Oregon, we have a mandate for clean air purposes now in wintertime months in the Portland area, and we believe that the mandates help to bring that benefit and the consumer price benefits to the entire state, and it makes sense to be selling a fuel in this state that we're producing here at home.
Very good.
Thank you very much.
Very informative. Okay, if there's nothing further to come before the committee, what bills do we have open, both 22, all three of them?
Yeah, 22, 10, 11, and 12.
Okay, 22, 10, I mean, 10, 11, and 12. With the tap of the gavel, we will close the hearing, public hearing on those, and we'll also be adjourned.